Good. So yesterday we continued into the Gemara, and we noted, like we did with the Pesukim, that a lot of what's going on in the Gemara is reactive rather than yes, meaning it's rather than initiating law, in many ways it's codifying, it's responding to realities. And you get that a lot, right? That there seems to be this principle that really what there's kirva. Like kirva is like the overarching principle, and based on the Gemara's comparison to Yibum, and this is pretty explicit on Kuf Yotet, right, where it makes Yibum and Yerusha two sides of the same coin, you also start to realize that Yerusha is less about the property per se, or not necessarily only about the property, but is also about what that represents in terms of shame or legacy. Right? So those are some of the things that start to emerge just by a simple read of the Gemara. And to be fair, a lot of that was already emergent from the Pesukim that we did 2 days ago. So let's just read a few more lines on Kofi and Tet, and then let's try to bring some of these issues together. Okay? So the Gemara, I don't know if we'd read this line, but let's pick up with it anyways. So the Gemara says, Ema she'erosa melame sha'av kodem libas. Why don't you say that the father comes before the daughter? Right? And that, why don't you make that derivation from the word she'er? Talmud lomar, ha'karov, karov, kodem. Confusing. Talmud Lomar HaKarov, quote, Karov Kodem. The closer you are, the earlier you are in the inheritance process. And then, the Gemara's assumption is, yet again, that the principle of who should be in the line of succession is determined by kirva, by relationship and closeness of relationship. And then the Gemara says, how do I know that fathers are not as close as daughters? Maybe the order should be son, father, daughter, brother, uncle. Right? What's the Gemara's answer? Chevan dil'inyan yibum. Ben uvat ki hadode ninu. Since for the purposes of Yibum, sons and daughters are the same, therefore, l'inyan nachala nami venuvat ki hadodin yenu. And again, this was where we had left off yesterday and jumped to Kuf Yotet and said, well, what exactly is the Gemara getting at? What the Gemara is getting at is if a daughter can carry on her father's legacy, i.e., proven from the fact that you don't do Yibum if someone has a daughter. And since the paradigm of Nachala in the mind, the Gemara's mind is carrying on, seems to be carrying on legacy. So if a daughter can do that, then the daughter is clearly a closer relative than the father. Right? Yes, Ezra.
Is it for Yibum, is it the first kid or the first son of the Yibum marriage as it's like counted as the son of the first brother?
Unclear. Meaning, the exact, how much of the Yibum affects only the first child or later children, are there any implications, or is that just the goal of it, right, is a very complicated by several sugyas in Yibum. So, we'll bracket it, right? There are implications that it might apply to every child that's ever born, meaning that the Yibum shapes the marriage forever, and therefore all children are defined in that context. There is an implication of that in the Yerushalmi, it depends on how you understand the Yerushalmi, which is a machloket, Rishonim and Achronim, but I'm overcomplicating things, and I'm not going to do this to you right now. Okay. By the way, parenthetically, can someone point to a pasuk that uh, in not vague, I'll be vague for now, that highlights the extent to which having children is almost definitionally in the mind of the Torah about passing on a shame.
Well, it was when it testified that there were rebuilds and rebuilds.
Okay, good. That's a good one. Can anyone give me a haftarah that we might or might not read many times during the year?
Many times during the
year. Yes, many times right there. Not Rosh Chodesh. We don't have Haftarah on Rosh Chodesh. We don't have a Haftarah on Rosh Chodesh. No. Shabbos Rosh Chodesh we do. Oh, okay, fine. But no. Like, normal Rosh Chodesh doesn't. How about a fasting? There's a Tanya's keyboard. Do you remember the Haftarah? What does God say? So what if, yes, that was one of the only examples. Good. What does God say? Yes, who is he going to give a Yad Vashem to? A Yad Vashem is a memorial. Well, why is God promising that he will give a legacy and a memorial to somebody? Because who is he promising he will give it to? The Sarisim, the people who are... impotent, who can't have children. No? No? Seriously, no? No? Here. Okay. I'm not going to... What?
At that point in the day, I'm
sorry,
I want to just, like, $7.
Yes, I know. There, you have never listened to the words that you are that are being said.
Not that formally.
Unbelievable. Let 1 second. Let me read it to you. There you go. Oh, Rami, are you remembering it, or do I have to read it to you?
I remember.
You remember bits and pieces. Okay, do you remember the relevant bits and pieces? That's really the question I'm asking here. What? Get the page. It'll be easier this way. Rega. How do they organize this thing? Honestly, how do they organize like this appendix thing? No? No, Rami, not. I won't make fun of you if you make a mistake, as long as you try. I'm only half promising that, but I'll do my best, okay? Here, 1,050. There we go. Okay. Here, I'll read it to you. God says, Ko amar Adonai, shimru mishpat v'asu tzedakah, right, observe justice, perform righteousness, because I'll save you, etc. Ashrei enosh yaseh zot, uven adam yachazigba, shomer shabbat mechalelo, v'shomer yado me'asot kol ra. Right, praiseworthy is the person who does this, the person who keeps Shabbat, who keeps himself back from doing evil. Ve'al yomar ben ha-nechar ha-nilvel Adonai le'mor ha-vdel yabilani Adonai me'alamo v'yomar ha-saris hein ani tavesh. The non-Jew who's chosen to join God should not say, God has separated me from his people. And the eunuchs, the people who can't have children, should not say that I am a shriveled up dry tree. Kicho amar Adonai l'saritim asher yishmeru et shavdodai v'acharu b'asher chafasti u'machazikim b'briti. Because so said God to the saritim, to the people who can't have children, who keep the Torah. V'natati lahem b'veiti v'chomotai yad v'ashem. I will give them in my house a legacy, a commemoration. Tov mi banim u'mi banav. which is better than children. Shem Olam Etein Lo. I will give them an eternal name, Asher Lo Yikare. Yeah, what's the point? That's the end. That's later. Thank you. But that's later. But what's the point? Right? The point is that people who can't have children, their fundamental fear is that they won't have a shame. And therefore God promises them a better shame. Right? So this link between legacy, between a shame and having a child is central, is given, right? What? And the connection, therefore, to Yerusha, which is bound in the Yibum connection, is important, right? Because they're two sides of the same coin. The natural way to have a shame is a child. And if you don't, then you do Yibum. But that's why Yerusha and Yibum are two sides of the same coin, right? Just like you find in that Nevuah, that God promises a replacement for those who have a children to find a different way to keep on their shame. The same, that's what Yibum is doing. Okay? One of those things, guys, you know, paying attention to the things we read. What? Yeah. Look, I will never forget. I come back to this every so often, but I remember one of my cousins putting it this very succinctly. I don't want to die, go to heaven, have Yechezkel come over to me and say, hey, did you ever read my book? Right? I just don't want this, okay? You don't want to be in that situation, right? Not with Yechezkel, not with Ishayahu, not with Yirmiyahu, not Amos, not that I know what heaven looks like, but, you know. Yeah, but you know what? When Nietzsche comes to me and says, you read my book, assuming he's in heaven, which I'm really not assuming. I'm assuming, but assuming they give him reprieve from wherever he is, right? I'll be like, yes, in fact, I read some of your books. That's why I didn't read the rest of them, because I couldn't, right? They're quite painful, honestly. They really are. As insightful as he was about the modern condition. What? No, I don't think Yechezkel's only going to ask about the parts in the Haftarah. I don't know whether he'll ask you anything, but the point is, you better know Tanakh. And Yechezkel will say, I was before yeshivas, and when you came up with this idea that yeshiva guys don't have to learn Tanakh. You know, he'll say, look. And Yechezkel will say, oh, I get it now. I'll go back to God and say, why do you give us those messages? Didn't you know yeshiva guys don't need them? They only need Baba Basra, right? And then you'll go to God, and God will say, oh, it's okay. Yep, you're right. I didn't really mean it when I said that these things were important. You're right. I just didn't think it was important. Yep, that's a very plausible. That is very plausible. Thank you, Yaakov.
But it says around all you have to split your time between
Sometimes I really do think that my primary language is sarcastic cynicism, and then like I sometimes pepper it with other types of talk. You know, I'm never quite sure. Anyway, the Gemara then continues. The Why don't you just say that the drasha is coming to teach you that fathers come before fathers' brothers, and what the Gemara is. And Yachol Yaakov Asan Tam Lomar Karov Karov Kodem, and then say, but the father comes before uncles, but not before brothers, because brothers are closer. So what is the Gemara answer? Obviously, Achayav Lotzichei Kra. That's obvious. Why is that obvious? The fact that paternal uncles are not as close as your father. Why is that obvious? Yes, right. This wasn't a big kiddush, right? The Gemara says, well, you don't need a pasuk to tell me that, because Acheha Av Mikoach Ma'ana Ka'atu Mikoach Av Koi. Mikoach Av Koi Av Koi Yarte. Acheha Av, right, okay. Meaning, paternal uncles is obvious because right, paternal uncles are related to the father. Now, there's an interesting and will be important ambiguity here, Which is, okay, let's follow the Gemara's logic. The Pasuk She'iro tells you that a father is closer than a brother. Yes? That means that there's three categories of people, right? There are people who are obviously closer than a father. Who are those people? Sons and daughters. There are people who are obviously not closer. Those would be uncles. And then there are people who might or might not be closer than a father. And the Pasuk tells you that fathers are closer. Who does that apply to?
Brother.
Right, that's the Gemara's description. Now, someone tell me how to conceptually explain that weird state. Why is it that brothers need a pasuk, right? Explain to me the hava amina, that fathers are not as close as brothers, and the maskana that she'iro tells you that they are. Okay, I want to be very careful. We're going to come back to this, but I want you to be very careful. What might be going on there? Okay, so Yaakov gives me the following genetic, right, modern genetic answer, which is, there is a deep truth to saying that it's ambiguous who is closer to you, genetically, your father or your brother, because you share 50% of your parents, each of your parents, right, genetic material. So in that sense, you know, your father is 50% related to you, right, or 50% related to you, 50%, right, you share genetically. Your brother... You might be more different. On the other hand, you know, you both share, your father doesn't share genetic material from your mother. Your siblings, right, they do, and therefore they're actually a similar mix, right? So there is like a sort of genetic logic there where it's unclear. On the one hand, you don't get genetic material from your brother, but your brother, unlike your father, has the same genetic sources where your father doesn't, right? There's a sort of genetic suffix there, right? Okay, good.
She'ero.
Oh, no, so it's not obvious. That's exactly the point, right? Meaning? It does. That's exactly the Gemara's point. Is that since it's obvious, the pasuk doesn't need to teach you father before uncle. It needs it to teach you father before brother, meaning brothers are in the weird case where if it weren't for the pasuk, you would be stuck figuring out who comes first, father or brother. Good. So I understand the Hava Amina, right? The Hava Amina, let's take Yaakov's model. The Hava Amina is that there's good reason to think that you're closer to your father. There's good reason to think you're closer to your brother. The pasuk comes to now do what? Okay. So, there's a minimalist read, which is to teach you that the father comes before a brother. That's a minimalist read. What would be a maximalist read? I'm being vague here. Let's follow the internal logic of the Gemara. Right, remember, what's the Gemara's number one rule about who comes first in Yerusha? Hakarav Karav Kodem. Good. Now, the Gemara had a suffix following the rule of Karav Karav Kodem, who comes first, father or brother? So the Gemara introduces a pasuk. So, but what does the pasuk do? Someone tell me what the pasuk does. No. We established Karav Karav Kodem. Right. But what?
How can you go in that contradictory because
they
can't go based off the
pasuk? Oh, good. So here's exactly what Ellie said. Ellie gave both possibilities. And I don't think he realized he said both possibilities. But watch what Ellie did. You did say both, but I don't think he realized he said both. Possibility one is The Hava Mina was that fathers and brothers in certain senses, but maybe in different ways, are equally related to the deceased, right? And yet, the father inherits before because there's a Gzerada Katuv that tells you that despite the fact that at a deep level they're really equally related, we need to pick somebody, so the pasuk comes and pushes father higher up in the or closer, whatever. But conceptually, fathers and brothers are still equally related. Or, meaning, this is a exception to the rule of a karav kodem. Because really, at a deep level, fathers and brothers are equally related, but you need to pick somebody, so the Gzeres HaKatuv comes in and just pushes the father earlier in the chain without changing the fundamental principle that fathers and brothers are equally related. Or, She'ero reveals that what? That conceptually the father actually is closer than the brother. Now, why does this matter? So it turns out, hopefully I'll get this to you inside, but I'll just tell you in advance that this is actually Machloket Rishonim. Because there are two ways of viewing how brothers inherit. One is horizontally, the other is vertically, meaning the father is Yorish Bekever, right? Meaning the father in potential inherits, right? But he's dead, and therefore, who are his heirs? The brothers, right? Meaning, how do brothers inherit? Are they considered relatives through the father, or are they considered direct relatives? That seems to be...
The Gemara, you do.
The uncles, everyone agrees, it goes to the father. Right, and that's why the Gemara says you don't need a pasuk.
Right.
But brothers, it's a suffix. So the question I would have in the Gemara is, the Havamina was brothers and fathers are equal. What's the maskana? Is the maskana that fathers and brothers are at some level equally related, but we need have a pasuk that pushes the father off, or is it revealing something deep about the way Yerusha works, which is your brothers are actually not related to his brothers, they're more correctly
your father's sons.
And that's what it's revealing. Right? And therefore, it's revealing, exactly, it's not just like there's a pasuk, the pasuk is revealing the fact that the proper way to view your brothers is as father's sons, and then memela, it's obvious that the father comes before brothers. That's a machloket Rashbam Ramban. The Rashbam Ramban argue at exactly that point. Of limaskana, do we view brothers as direct heirs conceptually or heirs through the father? But that hangs on how you read the role of this Gzeres HaKatuv. Is it telling you, yes, brothers and fathers are equally related, but you need to pick somebody? Gzeres HaKatuv. Or does the Gzeres HaKatuv reveal that the father, in fact, is a closer relative? And yes, biologically, right, knowing the science of genes, you could see it both ways, right? There's a scientific way of framing both of these, right? Mitzad echad, right? On the one hand, it's true that your brother is actually directly related to you in a way that your father isn't, because you both share genetic material from the same two people, right? And actually, therefore, have a similar mix in a way that your father doesn't. On the other hand, there's a deep genetic logic to saying your brother's only related to you through your parents, in the sense that the way you ended up sharing that genetic material, right, is because of your father, right? There's a genetic, right? I could use genetic talk to explain both formulations, right? On the one hand, my brother is my father's son, and that's why I'm related, because we're both our father's son. On the other hand, my brother is he who shares my mother and father's genetic material just like I do, right? And therefore, I share, right? I share 50% of the genetic material with my father because he gave it to me, and I share 50% approximately of my genetic material with my siblings because we have the same mix of genes, right? So there is a genetic logic to both of those, to saying my son, my brother is really my father's son, and that's how we're related, or no, we're directly related because we are both the unique mixes of 50% genetic material, right? There's a logic to both of those. I'm thinking about this as I, you know, finish up a book on the history of the gene. And as I was reading it, I'm like, hey, it's a good thing I'm reading this while I'm learning Yesh Nochlin, because you can put Yesh Nochlin language in, not that I didn't know that basic, you know, at least basic genetics, I assume you learned in like fourth grade or something.
I mean, the more I've learned about one genetics, like the little bit I've learned in my biology class, like the more I realize that it's like all a sham and like a...
No, it really isn't, Rami.
No, it's just something that is a whole lot of oversimplification.
Yes, that's true. Yes. It's genetics. Well, many people in my family just like genetics. I mean, my mother, before she decided to stay in epidemiology, started a PhD in genetics and then decided to stay in epidemiology. My sister-in-law is finishing her PhD in genetics. I gotta ask her. I have to work on that all, so. You're not putting pressure on. Look, we have Berman tomorrow. We also have another thing in the morning tomorrow from Masta or something, right? And then there's a lot of, because of COVID, there's all these people that, like, you know, I've got to figure out how many I actually get. But yes, because, you know, see, I wasn't rushing to get him this year because I was squashed on time. And I was like, oh, I'm able to do it next year. But since you're here, that gives me a reason to do Dafka now. So I will try. Yes, Roy Sender also wants to come. What? I don't know. I talked to him. He also wants to come, but I'm trying to work out schedules. And then we're having, plus I have to factor in Dubai, right? So, like, I'm trying here, people, right? Look, just remember, most of this year, usually there are trips and there are speakers. And there's some sort of balance between them. This year, we couldn't do many trips, so we were plugging in speakers, whatever. Now I'm letting Roy Wasserman, you know, do his thing. Go up to Arabaya and go to Dubai, go to whatever. Just, because, you know, you've heard people talk enough. Yes, I know you want to hear other people, and yes, I'm trying to deal with all of these. Yes, he would like to come and teach you how to meditate. Yes. Ellie's cousin would like him to do his presentation. Yes. That's what I ask him all the time, because I have to factor into scheduling. Yes, I believe there are. What? Do I know? No, I don't know. I think there are other things, but I don't know. Yes. Him, Shmuel David, I don't know. Really, no. You know, I'm trying, Ellie. I am trying my best to not over-inundate the schedule of the speakers. Yeah, and I was shopping on Friday, and Jeffrey Wolf came over to me. He's like, before I said anything, he's like, I owe you a shear. I'm like, yes, we've literally been doing this for 2.5 years. We're trying to work it out. And every time I see him, that's the first thing we talk about. Yeah, there's, you know, getting there. Plus, there's all the, you know, like the... Plus all like the practical things, like why are you coming to do academic advisement and like things like that. So like that also gets into schedules. Yeah. Okay. But we're going to see that's really in Machloket in the Ramban Rosh book. Okay. Fine. Let's pause there in reading the Gemara. I want to show you something, how a lot of this comes to expression in the Rishonim. So remember, one of the things that we were struck by was that Yerusha law almost sounds like an afterthought in the Torah, right? If it weren't for the fact that there was someone who didn't have a son, the Torah wouldn't have bothered coming and telling us this whole thing, meaning everybody knew that sons inherited, right? So now let me introduce you to different types of mitzvah. Okay, Ellie? some mitzvot properly thought of are mitzvot to do an act that were not for the Torah, right, wouldn't have been valuable, right? That's what I think when we think of many mitzvot, right? Or even would have been valuable. Meaning, a mitzvah is often, God tells you to do X. If he didn't tell you to do X, either it would have no value whatsoever. Right? Right? Like shotness or something, right? Or blowing the shofar or whatever. Or it might have had value, but it wouldn't have been a command. It would have been a moral value. I don't know. Speaker called that. It wouldn't. No, I'm saying, or it could be a moral value, like visit the sick. Without God, it was a moral value, and now it's also a religious value. Okay? Fine, but... But that's not the categorization I want to focus on. But then, there are laws that aren't like that at all. There are laws where, if it weren't for the Torah, these things would happen, and they would not be religiously or morally charged at all. And the role of the Torah is not to add a religious dimension to a moral law, nor is it to create value. It's merely to regulate. What do I mean? What do I mean? Let's say Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Basra all disappeared from the face of the earth with all the psukim that came with them in the Torah, okay? And now Ezra and Eli decide that they want to start a business together. And they are, what business are you starting, Ezra and Eli?
We're going to sell shoes for them.
They're going to sell shoes for dogs. Wow, that was very specific. Amazing. It's like, you never know. And gloves. Gloves and shoes for dogs. Very good. Now, so Ezra and Eli now have to write a contract between them, a partnership agreement, right? Then they get their first customer, Gavi. Gavi wants his dogs to have shoes and gloves. Apparently. So now they want to sell it to Gavi. Wonderful.
He doesn't pay us.
So what?
He doesn't pay us.
And he doesn't pay us. Right, they don't pay. He doesn't pay. So now they have to go to the judge. The judge is Rami. Right? No, the executioner is Yaakov. Right. No. Let's say there was no Torah.
Yeah.
What would you do? What would happen?
I would say, okay, can you give me results? You could probably, legal code. And
what legal code?
We do have something like a just rational
life. Right, meaning there are certain things in life where the idea that if you have a partnership, you have to come up with some principles, and if you sell things, right, people should pay you, and if they don't pay, there should be some way of dealing with it. That's like... every human society just has that. If there wasn't a Torah, we would come up with a system. When the Torah comes in, so it might just be that it's regulating fundamentally a non-religious system, right? Meaning, that's not fundamentally religious. It's just like, every side needs it. And the Torah, because it includes ritual law and moral law, but also social, you know, what, civil law, sometimes it merely regulates things that would have existed in any, every human society, right? And therefore, the mitzvah properly articulated isn't to do this, but rather, when you do this, use the Torah's rules. Is that clear? No, I'm not sure it's clear. Is it clear? Meaning? Yeah.
Because I know with Noah, one of the things is to establish sports, and there are no details even as to what those sports are, meaning there is some necessity, there is a, it's not that no matter what, every society is going to have legal system, otherwise that would be completely pointless to think about, or something else.
No, or every society should have a legal system, right?
I mean, yeah.
I mean, they will, it's just they should, right? Yes, I mean, some people will choose anarchy, but that's a problem.
Right, and everyone should not be a Buddhist-Ara, and that doesn't mean I wouldn't say that doesn't have to lose that
place. No, I don't think it's the same, right? Meaning, most societies have just intuitively decided they need some sort of legal system, right? What legal system, whether it's a fair legal system, is a different story. Right? We have to get into the question of what that mitzvah actually means, which is a machlok rishonim and a charnim.
I think I heard that there was like parallel Jewish one, but what about like for the thousands of years now?
Okay. Yes, the Ramah in Tshuva Yud expands upon the Ramban in Rishon Lamed Gimel and says that dinim should reflect the Jewish system in a certain sense. No, that is not obvious.
What about before the Jewish system was given? Interesting.
Yeah, no, that wasn't obvious. I know the Ramah says it. I'm aware the Ramah says it. Thank you. I'm glad someone once taught you that Ramah. I know that the Ramah says it. I've read the Ramah. It doesn't get less weird when you read the Ramah. It doesn't matter that it's the Ramah plus the Ramban, who are both very important people. It doesn't get less weird. No, the Rambam doesn't buy it.
Well, why is that necessary?
Who taught you that Ramah?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I learned it as the Ramah, but
oh, that makes sense. That makes sense. Who's Sharia? Oh, that, yeah, that's the answer. You should have said, I was like, in the back of my mind, I'm like, is it Noah? Yes, that was actually what I was thinking. Was it Noah who taught you? And what? Is Rabbi Noah Garden Schwartz, right? Like we were in YU together and Gush together at different points, right? And I would, like as soon as you said that, I'm like, that I feel like I knew you had had him at some point. I'm like, I feel like he would have quoted that Ramah. And I feel vindicated. I was right. Oh, look at that. Look at that. And yes, Ezra Me'achuz, I totally see him actually having taught you that Ramah, and yes, I'm like imagining it now. It could even be I've heard it first from him. I'm trying to think. I feel like I had this discussion with him at some point. Let's see, when he came back to learn at Gush, he spent his free time learning Sanhedrin. No, but he was learning Elohim and Nisrafen. Yeah, holy, yeah, we discussed it. Not yet, ninth parak.
What's that about?
Srefa. Anyway. Fine. So, let's look at the Rambam. Okay? I want to read two formulations in the Rambam, which seem to be at odds with each other, but then I want you to tell me where this comes from. Look at number four. Har mitzvah haresh memchet. What is the 248th positive mitzvah, i.e. the last one, last mitzvah to say? Ki ha-Torah she-horeinu b'dinei nachalav. What does that mean? He taught us? Yeah, that's not the word I was looking at. She-horeinu b'dinei nachalav. Someone tell me what that means. No, hore, teaches. The laws of Nachala. Okay. Someone tell me what's weird about that formulation in the Rambam. No, he did. What word did he not use? What language is very clearly missing here? Yeah, there's no active language. He taught us the laws of Nachala. What does that imply? Yeah, right? It sounds like what the Rambam telling you. Remember the diyuk we picked up in the Pasuk? God doesn't need to tell you to bequeath property. He doesn't have to teach you that there's such a thing as Yerusha. Why not? Right. Everyone knows it. It's natural. What does it need to do, if anything? Yeah, it needs to regulate it, provide the details of that, but it doesn't need to create the system of Yerusha. What would be the hint that that's true? And again, the fact that over and over, every time we read the Parshat Nachalot,
I would assume that might be something far away from the fact that the person who this
is
presented to is dead.
Ah! Oh, thank you, Rami. I was waiting for somebody to say it. Now, besides for the implications in the Pasuk that we saw, namely that the Torah seems to be responding to a reality, the other indication that maybe this is a unique type of mitzvah, where it's not an active mitzvah, it's rather when you're going to bequeath, because you're going to do it as a natural thing, the Torah is merely regulating it. It's regulating, right? It's not creating something. It's regulating something that already existed. A certain sense was intuitive, and that's what Ola and the Gemara, that's what Ola from the Pesukim, that a certain level of Yerusha is just intuitive. The Torah just on the margin has to sort of deal with details. So part of it is just that it was a human institution that always existed. But Rami adds the obvious point. There's another reason to think that Yerusha isn't a classic mitzvah, and that is because it always applies to people who are dead. Right? Oh, very good. So Ellie responds and says, that's one way of thinking about it, but there is another way of thinking about it. What's the other way of thinking about it, Ellie? And who are those people? Yeah, who is that? Ah, so good. So Rami, I think, is capturing the diukim, the psukim, and the obvious, well, the guy's dead. And that's, I think, what leads to Rambam's formulation of the Sefer HaMitzvah. But Eli says there's another way of thinking about this, which is the way I think the Rambam himself deals with it, not in the Sefer HaMitzvah, but in his listing of the mitzvot, and that is, why don't you read it for yourself? Because there seems to be tension. What does he say? Number five? Mitzvah Reish Mem Chet. Bidine nachalot. Okay, what does that mean? Just those three words. Ladun bidine nachalot. What does that mean? To judge. So there are two ways of dealing with this. If you want to say that it's an active mitzvah, then what do you need to do? You need to find a living address for that mitzvah. And who is that address? So it could have been the relatives, right? But the Rambam seems to choose the judges, right? The court system. The alternative is what Rami said, is to pick up on the fact that all the language in the Pesukim seems to be very passive, right? Which is the Torah just responding to a reality. To pick up on the fact that the Gemara bases so much of this on logic. It's just sort of at the margins, tweaking what everyone seems to have known which was true, and say, Yerusha is not a normal mitzvah. Yerusha isn't a mitzvah to do something. It's a mitzvah that when Yerusha happens, because it just happens, it's just what people do, it has to be regulated by the Torah. But it's not really a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to follow certain regulations rather than an active mitzvah to do something. But if you want it to be more active, you've got to find an address for that. Very good. So now, as Ellie says, the question to the extent to which any of what I just said is true, depends on what?
Depends on.
So that was the first point you said, but now you just said something else which is very important.
Depends on
how. And it touches on what Gavi said yesterday. It touches on what, Gavi? Remember, we noted that there's a lot of verbs being mentioned in Yerusha. Some are active and some are passive. Some of them are yitain, yakir, right? Some of them are passive, like yisod, right? Some of them are vaha'avartem, you shall let it pass, right? One of the questions you need to answer in Yerusha is, how do we conceptualize Yerusha? Is Yerusha something that happens by itself? Someone dies, the property passes of its own accord to the heirs, and now the role of everyone else around is what? Just to make sure that people aren't unfairly gypped of the things that have already come to them by right? Or do you view Yerusha as some sort of active passing on a property, right? Sort of like an acquisition posthumously. Now, of course, there's always the possibility that what?
It's just
there's also the possibility what? What's always the possibility in Lumdos? Always. Thank you. It's Sveidinim. Very good. In brisker terminology, it's Sveidinim, right? As I've said before, I don't know what brisk is, but when you say Sveidinim, then you know you're talking brisk because you're using the classic brisker terminology in the original Yiddish, right? What does Sveidinim mean, Yaakov?
Two
laws. This, right? Meaning there's some Yerusha which is active and some which is not. By the way, and this is what we'll do tomorrow, what's the most like, if I had to divide between Yerusha that's active and Yerusha that's not active, right, what is the most likely place to divide?
Whether or not there's a right player.
Be more precise, man.
Whether or not B is a son.
Oh, very good. Very good, Rami. Right? They're son or not? Why would I draw the line between a son and not son?
Oh, because if there's a son,
yes, because the implication of all the circumstances, if there's a son, I don't need to tell you what to do. It's obvious. What does that make it sound like? Yeah, if there's a son, you don't have to explain it because it just happens. If there isn't a son, so yes, Rami, you're 100% right that if there's a division between this, the most likely place for that to happen is between Yerusha and Aben and other Yerusha. And that's what we're going to start with tomorrow. But I already wanted you to note this, right? That even when the Rambam, there's a tension, that everything we picked up on in the Psukim, this passivity, this obvious nature that you're responding to something that exists, that tension exists right here in the Rambam. That the Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvot seems to sound like, yeah, Yerusha is really, it's not really a mitzvah, just something that sort of happens. The mitzvah is just to make sure that everything goes properly. Right, to regulate it. Because it's an existing human thing. You can't tell me it's a mitzvah to bequeath. Right? That's not a mitzvah. Everyone always bequeaths. The only possible mitzvah is to regulate it, to make sure it gets, right? And if you want to say it's active, the most likely place for it to be active is the courts. Okay. Look at the Sefer HaChinuch. Okay? Sefer HaChinuch in 6 says, Mitzvat dinei nachalot. Shenitzaveinu b'dinei nachalot. We were commanded about the laws of nachalah. But then he says, what does that mean? Kilomar. Meaning to say, shemitzvah aleinu la'asot viladun b'inyan ha'nachalah kasher dana tarala. That means, this is obviously him combining the two Rambams, saying which Rambam does he prioritize? He understands the Rambam's Nehra Mitzvot in light of, in the Minyan HaMitzvot. The mitzvah is active on the courts. Shnei Emar, Ish Ki Amud, Veni Lo, Bavar, Tem Enach, Lo, Dovido, Vemein Lo, Bat, Vigomer. Vaitah, Le, Vene, Shalok, Chukam, Mishra, Gershet, Tiva, Hashem, Moshe. Va'al Tachshov, but then he continues. Don't think, Sha'amri, Bazeh, Shaham, Mitzvah, don't think that what I mean by the mitzvah is following Nachalad is said in the Torah, Sharzelo Marshi Adam Mitzuveh Meha'el, La Tate Masha Yeshlo Yersho Al Kol Panim. Don't think that this is a mitzvah on the dead to give the property to the heirs. Why? Because he's dead. And then he says, Ki ha'el baruchu, because God, lo ratza lehotzi nichtei ha'adam mirishuto. God didn't want to take the property away from people. Shelo lato mehem kol chedzo bishvil yarsho kol od nishmato bo. Kimosh yashivu chachmei ha'umot. He didn't want to take away the possibility of someone doing whatever he wants, as long as he's alive, like some non-Jews think. Aval hodienu says, chut hayoresh kashur binichtei morisho. What is Yerusha really telling us? That the rights of the heir are inherent. Kashur binichtei morisho. They inhere in the properties of the father, of the relative. Uvehistalek koach ha-morish, when the power of the bequeather is removed. That's a nice way of saying when he dies. Therefore, mina nechasim bimoto, his power is removed from the property when he dies. Miyad nofel aleihem zchut hayoresh, the rights of the heirs inhere automatically. Ki inyan tishtalshilut hayitzirut, it's just natural passing on. Shiratayu zer baruchu achazem bibli hefsek. One second. Rabotinu zechonam levracha yichru l'zchut hachazak hazeh sheyesh liyorshei v'nechtei marishov lashon mishmush. This strong connection that people have to Yerusha is called mishmush. Ki lashon amram baharmei v'kamot nachala mimameshet v'holechet, that the property just continues. Klomar, what does that mean? Shezchut hayoresh b'morish, the right of the heir to the bequeather, ki ilu hagufim divukim zebazeh, or as if their bodies are already attached. Shekol hayotzei min ha'echad nofel al hasheni, and therefore whatever comes from one automatically goes to the other. Umipneichein, and that's the reason for the halachan kufchavav, shem sivav omar ha'morish al yirisheni v'ni, and that's why if someone says, my son shall not inherit, Ein bidvarav mamash. It is meaningless. She'ein biyado la'akor davar ha'el she'amar shirash ha'yoresh mirisho. Because he has no power to say that the heir doesn't inherit. So what does he say? He says on the one hand, the mitzvah is clearly on the basis. But why can't it be on the yoresh? Not just because he's dead. He has a more fundamental reason. What is it, Rami? Yerusha, in his mind, is fundamentally what? Passive. Automatic. Why is it automatic? Because at some level, the heir is part of the bequeather, and therefore the connection is inherent. Well, he doesn't say that.
Well, you have to say that, because otherwise it's not supposed to make
sense. So Yaakov says, very good. Maybe he's only the son. I'm setting you up for tomorrow. Yes. Now, tell me, Yaakov, what would be a good test to see whether this type of Yerusha is only for a son? What would be a test?
Like a case where there are
no sons. So one would be, how do you understand a case when there are no sons? What's another good test?
Oh, well, your daughter's dead versus
daughter's good. Give me another one.
Dead versus not dead versus what never existed.
How about the following?
What?
Property versus non-property. Could Yerusha apply to non-monetary things?
Like what?
And that's what you'll learn tomorrow, right? Once you start saying Yerusha isn't really giving property, what is it?
It's
a implicit passing down, because the heir is essentially, in a certain sense, connected to the bequeather, right? And it's
implicit, and the best you can say is either the mitzvah to regulate or the mitzvah on the court to make sure that things happen properly. But fundamentally, it's a response to a deep truth about reality, right? It might be more expansive than property, which makes sense. So remember, what did we see in Yibum? It's not really about property. What is it about? Property itself is an expression of a more fundamental reality. Right? Now the language the Sefer HaChinuch gives you number 7 in the context of Yibum is helpful. And this is how they often quote it, which is, look at Mishorsha Mitzvah, why does Yibum work? Lefi Shehaisha Achar Shenisei Leish, once a woman is married to a man, Harehi Ke'echad Me'evarav, she's part of his body. Shekein Yechayev HaTeva, based on nature, why is marriage as if you become one body? Because that's how it happened with Adam and Chava, right? That's tapping into, right? Umimena banaloa el isha. Va'ish hazeh shemeit b'lo banim sheyechelik menu zikaron lo malot mekomol ba'olam lavodot baro. And therefore, if a person has no sons, what is he missing? Listen to his language. Someone limalot mikomol to take his place. V'od ein zecher lo ba'olam, and he has no commemoration in the world like gufanizu latizod aisha. So then he goes on to say, so what is Yibum? Hayam michazdei ha'el alav lakim lo zerem eno yidei achiv shu gam kin chati b'saro. Yibum is, you take the wife, which is half of his body, and the brother, who shares his genetic material, you mix them together and create a son. Right? That's his argument. That's what Yibum is. Yes. I see your, and yes, he does, he might mean this Kabbalistically, right? Because Alder Hasod, it might be a Gilgul, yes. The Kabbalists really do believe that, yes. But for my purposes, all I want to point out is that once you recognize that Yerusha might be not really about, it might be passive, because it's about the intrinsic connection between heirs and the bequeathers, and therefore it's really a reflection of a much deeper principle, and that's why the language used is passive, right? You might come up with surprising things, but you might also distinguish between different types of Yerusha. Okay, let me summarize what we've seen and then we'll stop for today. But what we saw today is, okay, we finished our discussion of Hakarav Karav Kodem, noting that Yerusha seems to be reflecting on a principle of closeness, right, of relationship, where, and we noted the ambiguity by the end of the sugya, whether that's true lamaskana. It's true of most cases. It's true of parents, of children, rather. It's true of uncles. But the question of where brothers and fathers fall, we raise the possibility that either She'ero is revealing that, in fact, fathers are more closely related than brothers, or it's breaking the rules, right? That was the first thing we did. The second thing we did was go back to what we'd been talking about in the Psukim, which is, what do we do with the fact that the Torah seems to be responding to reality rather than commanding it? And we know there's a bit of an ambiguity here. The Rambam, the Sefer Mitzvot, implies that the reason that's true is because this mitzvah is really about regulation rather than commanding. But if you want to say it's commanding, then what you need to do is put the onus on somebody else. Both the Rambam and the Chinuch seem to put it on the court. This leads us to the next question, which is part of the reason that you might not want to even go in that direction and say it's really about regulating, it's not active in any sense, is because you're going back to Gavi's question, how much do you view Yerusha as active, meaning you're giving someone property, and how much do you see it as passive? That Yerusha is really a function of an inherent connection between heir and bequeather and the property, which is an expression of that. The more you think that it's just that, the more passive it is. The more you think that, no, they're not that connected, and therefore you actually have to pass the property on, the more you conceptualize it as active, the more you're going to need an outside role to be commanded. And the possibility that, based on the fact that these same principles generate not just Yerusha, but Yibum, are really part of a broader framework of legacy and the like, it's also possible that the laws of Yerusha may be more expansive than property law, but you might have to draw distinctions between the inheritance of children or sons and other inheritance, because maybe some Yerushot are about this sort of metaphysical connection between parent and child, heir and bequeather, and others are not and require more active, right? So it could be that these formulations will be more or less correct depending on what time of Yerusha we're talking about, and there might be halachic nafkaminas. Now Ellie's looking at what halachic nafkamina, but we'll see, because the laws of Yerusha may not only apply to what you classically think of as Yerusha. Okay? That's what we'll deal with tomorrow. Yes, Rob.